IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 72 of the Killing It, Podcast. So I'm Carl, joined today, as always, by Dave and Ryan. So anything going on this week? Going to baseball games?
There were no games, but I got on a boat on a lake. It was excellent. It was outside. It was very socially distant. It was as compliant as it could possibly be. I swear it almost felt normal. And if you know me, the very best part of the day was I went outside, I was in the sun, I came back in, no sunburn.
Oh, look at you. Now that's a trick. So I will have one next week, because this coming weekend, so I guess by the time the pod releases, it will be in the past. I am going to a virtual gaming conference this weekend.
Ooh.
Complete with like old school retro games shared online that you can do co-op together remotely, panels. Like, I am super excited about about creative people reimagining an online and a physical event online from the gaming community. So I'm hoping, first off, anybody knows me, this is my like nerd out fun topic. I'm super interested to come back with, oh, these are ideas that worked.
Well, and for me, I guess my first reaction would be, A, can they improve the experience of the virtual baseball game? And B, you know, the actual game where it's more than just fake crowd sounds. And then B, is there anything that we can apply, for God's sakes, to the vendor presentations in our own community?
Yeah,
because, ChannelCon was last week, and I think all of us were on it. It's just not the same.
That was one of the best executions I'd seen of the new format. I will definitely give it up for ChannelCon on that one. But I think we still have room to be creative.
Well, and that's the thing, right? We did one earlier this week that was, I mean, again, it was hosted, it was interactive, we gave away prizes, there was stuff going on, and people gave it good marks. So it, you know, as the lowered bars of you know, damning with faint praise, it sucked less, right? we have one coming up soon that's going to involve a virtual happy hour and a cheese board, and they're sending things out ahead of time, and it's going to have a social aspect to it. Step in the right direction. Like you said, not awesome yet, but I appreciate that people are listening, and boy.
It's the new awesome.
Yeah, yesterday somebody made the response. Somebody said, well, how are you doing? And the response was, I'm 2020 good. Which in any normal year would not be good, but this year, better than I have been.
Exactly.
That's pretty good. Well, I tell you what, Ryan, why don't you kick us off, because you came with one that you were fired up about.
I was fired up about this one, and we're actually going to include a couple of links in the notes, because this is a topic of importance that everybody is talking about. But the very first one that's going to be in there comes from our friends at the Harvard Business Review, and it's focused on the topic of remote work, but specifically that managers of remote teams are having trust issues. Now, if you guys will remember 5 months ago, 4.5 months ago, when we first got into this new situation of working from home, we made the observation that, hey, this actually kind of works, and people can be productive, and you can continue this infinitely into the future. And we had a question way back then of just how many people were going to stick with remote work post-pandemic. And that was actually the conversation that spurred our recurring segment number 3 on life post-pandemic. Will we ever fully go back to the office? Well, add a new layer of color here, because what the Harvard guys are saying is, you know, lots of managers don't trust you. They don't believe you're actually doing a good job, and they wish that they could drag you back into the office full time. Now, the reason I was fired up about this was, number one, not a surprise, because my prediction 4.5 months ago was technologically, productivity-wise, absolutely we can do 40% of the jobs in America remotely into the future. I think that's perfectly realistic. But asterisk, micromanagers of the world will unite and they will rear their heads and they will say, I ain't comfortable because I can't watch over your shoulder and manage the little things that you do. And I think that's exactly where we're at. This article includes not just the frustrating part of, yeah, there are trust issues like we predicted, but some legitimate recommendations about how to do this well. I'm of the opinion, and I want to hear from you guys, I think this is a new threshold for competitive advantage. Externally, because your people can be where they need to be and you can do a lot of work anywhere, anytime, but internally in the competition for talent. I think if you can manage a remote work team effectively, you're going to get a leg up on everybody coming out of this
thing. Let me add one layer to that, which is I think all three of us would agree like micromanagers suck. But
yes,
there are also, I don't even know the percentages, a huge percentage of the managers out there. Think about, and this is the next layer, we're now 5 going on 6 months into remote work, universal remote work. There's now people being promoted into management who are, by definition, they have to learn to be managers in a remote world. Will they be as successful once they go back to the office, right? Like, hey, meet your team for the first time.
Well, if you go back to the office. The other thing I'm going to link in, because there's some other research that I thought was timely. The National Bureau of Economic Research had some data that came out. Here's your scary stat. The average workday lengthened by 48.5 minutes in the weeks following the stay-at-home orders, and the number of meetings increased by 13%. So yeah, those micromanagers are out in force filling your calendar.
Well, and they also are spending money on software to monitor your eye movements and how much time you spend in front of the, not in our industry for the most part, but in
that's the data that really got me. From Ryan's article, the Harvard people showed, I mean, essentially double the dissatisfaction at the employee level of and in their balance of home life to work life, and their feeling of the tension of that was twice as bad for those people that are micromanaged. Meaning you're already home in a super stressful environment. Your kids can't go to school. You're locked down. You're trying to like work and watch the kids and like manage the house and be stressed. And micromanagers are making it twice as bad. Like, I'm with you, Ryan. I think this is an area where investment in culture management, building ability to actually manage teams, not micromanage them, but really focus on building a trusting environment where you can work with your people efficiently. Like, that's a competitive difference. I can get better talent because I don't burn them out, make them feel bad, make them unhappy at home. Like, it's a clear differentiation.
Absolutely. See, and my single biggest takeaway on this thing, you know, again, tactics is good and making this individual and what does this mean to you as a solution provider? There's a point in there, there's never enough acronyms, so they invented another one. ROWE, results only work environment. In other words, managers need to get it into their mind that we are not measuring the inputs, we are measuring the outcomes. We are not here to measure how many hours you work. We are here to say, did you achieve your objective? Did you hit your number? If you're in accounting, if you're in marketing, if you're in sales, I don't care what it is. Every single job can be managed by results. So, and if we can get off of the time checking, like punch the clock, and on to measure these humans by their productivity, holy cow, the world's going
to
be
amazing. Ryan, I have to ask the question. So that's, I will buy into that in the knowledge worker world, but not everybody's a knowledge worker. So can you eliminate micromanagers completely?
Well, you can minimize the impact even in, because specifically that ROWE concept, the results only work environment, is actually pioneered in like manual labor type job scenarios.
Right, right.
Because we, you know, again, I don't care how long it works. What's your piece rate, right? To go back to the very old days of manufacturing environments, if you turn out X number of widgets and they are of Y level of quality, cool. If it took you an hour, if it took you 100 hours, I don't care. You're getting paid by the piece. That was where this idea was born. And it makes even more sense in a knowledge worker environment. But again, you, Mr. Solution Provider, you, Mr. Technology Tools Vendor, the humans that listen to this program, A, stop making tools that allow people to track eye movement, because the karma on that is very, very
bad. Right. There is a special place in hell for those.
I don't want you to go to the horrible place for that one. But B, like, think about ways that we can empower the human connections and focus back on the results, because I think this is not only a tool sales opportunity, this is a professional services consulting opportunity for technology professionals to say, in the spirit of the SaaS marketplace, right? I am not here to sell you a license. I'm not here to sign you to a contract. I am here to ensure adoption and customer success post-sale. Get paid to teach your customers how to use remote collaboration technologies. Don't just sell them the stuff. Teach them how to do this well. That's recurring revenue on a professional services level, which is super high
margin. So it's interesting to me that there's almost this analogy to on-site hardware versus cloud storage, cloud services. There will be people that no matter what you do, they literally can't conceive of a world without me looking over your shoulder, right? I mean, it's like, they, in some ways, you just got to wait for them to get old and go away.
Or just choose to not work for them, right? There are other opportunities, go back to our competitive basis for new talent. Where you work is voluntary in a lot of cases. So please choose to work for managers who don't make you miserable.
The number one reason people leave employment is because of their boss.
Yeah,
that is the first line manager. Right, it is their first line manager. This is the number one reason. So I look at it and say, like, you, the owner, you, the business owner, should think of this as your competitive differentiation, and your job is to get rid of those bad managers because they are going to cost you talent. You can't keep good people if they're being micromanaged.
Well, and where I was going with this was also that, hey, if you've given up on installing servers on site, you should also give up on thinking that your technicians need to live within a 17-mile radius of your office.
Amen.
Because they don't. Because your clients don't even need to be within a 50-mile radius of your
Absolutely.
Office.
Absolutely. And again, real super personal on this application. Many of the people listening here are, you know, some are remote, some are all back in, some are hybrid, work from home, right? Think very carefully about the work-life satisfaction of your own engineers, your own human beings, because you think they're going to be loyal and stick around forever and ever because they always have. But if you burn them out, you're going to be searching for new employees pretty quick.
Well, we will certainly come back to this topic, but sadly, now it's time to move on. So topic number two, we're talk about, we'll revisit some of this in topic number three, but what are we doing with, the Chinese and basically putting sanctions on these other companies, these countries, and saying, all right, you know, can the United States and these other countries get along? Can we agree on what the rules are? You know, we talked about GDPR and privacy and all that on one hand, but this is talking about, are we going to actually divide up countries and say, you can't do business here. You can't do business with these companies. You can't do business on these, you know, services. There's a lot of U.S. companies that either are based in China or they get a bunch of parts from China. And it's probably the biggest disruption to most of our listeners has been the supply chain disruption during all of this craziness of 2020.
Well, the interesting thing, and it was funny because Carl, you brought the, so we've got two articles in the show notes. The first one you brought, which is around the Chinese companies that were added to the sanctions list over their Uyghur human rights violations. And if you're not aware of the story of the Uyghurs, we're not going to go down that particular rabbit hole, but I would highly encourage you to go listen and dig into that, because it's something you should know about from a human perspective. The story that came out at the same time that I was super interested in was the EU sanctioning Russian, Chinese, and North Korean specifically as retaliation for cyber attacks. And it was the first time the EU made a move specifically in this way. And anybody who's seen me, I don't know, over the past decade, talk about the fact that I found it interesting when NATO declared cyberspace the same level as a combat zone as physical. I think it's really interesting when the EU declares, hey, we're now going after people with specific economic sanctions over cyber attacks. And what I thought was interesting, and the reason this linked together for me, was this idea of sanctions now part of the technology landscape in a general sense. My thinking is, was wondering around the, are we going to see a lot more of these cyber circumstances, cyber results, cyber consequences for criminal activity around cyber?
Oh, this was not part of this article, but you know, just one little note to add to this is, you know, the Soviet Union, I'm sorry, Russia, put in a law last week that you can have cyber currency, but you can't use it to pay for stuff, which I thought was really interesting. Sort of like, you can use it to move money around, but you can't use it to pay for stuff, because they're literally responding to the rest of the world saying, the only reason Bitcoin exists is to get money illegally into Russia from ransomware, you know, which isn't 100% true.
Yeah, it's only uncomfortably accurate, not entirely accurate.
So let me posit a question to you guys that I've been kicking around and see your take on it. One of the things that I've been thinking about is the idea of consequences for cybercrime. That one of the reasons why we have it right now is that it is, I don't know, easy to do and profitable. And so we have lots of organized crime getting into it. How much do you think bringing significant monetary consequences to those found guilty will change behavior?
Well, see, you are going exactly where I was going to go on this topic. If you think of a few disparate themes that we've touched on, we talk about increasing regulation on technology service providers. We talk about the bifurcation of the internet. We talk about it is the virtual world becoming the real world, because they are increasingly inseparable. You cannot just say, well, there's things that happen over here, good, bad, and otherwise, and including crimes for which we have punishment. And then over here in the virtual world, well, it ain't real, so you can't really punish people for it. Yes, it is. Yes, you can. And I will go exactly where you were asking. I absolutely think you're going to see increased sanctions, increased regulation, whether it is monetary or, you know, I go back to a book that was written by a guy named Nicholas Carr. The Big Switch, right? And the front half of that, we all went, yep, I get utility computing. The second half of that book, we all went, oh crap, so like nation level cyber warfare, holy cow. He freaked everybody out. He was absolutely correct. That is going to become a new theater for dispute and conflict, and that has to be regulated. And I'll go back where you did, Dave. These sanctions were 100% justifiable, right? On that first article that's in there, those 11 companies, what's happening in the Uyghur situation, this is 100% justifiable and appropriate. But what it brings out is nobody yet has thought through carefully enough the domino effect of unintended consequences when you do this. Specifically, if all y'all sell Chromebooks or laptops or anything right now, good luck on fulfilling an order for Thanksgiving. Okay. Because of the ripple effect of nobody sanctioned the tier one OEMs, but the tier one OEMs do business with the people who are on the list. And therefore, our friends at Lenovo, supply chain hammered and millions of Chromebooks literally millions of Chromebooks committed to schools as student devices while we are trying to make this work and have kids do school remotely. Millions of those devices ain't going to show up by the first of the school year because they simply cannot ship through the inventory. Now, was the original action good? Yeah. Should we have thought more carefully about like the whoops, we just totally shot ourselves in our own foot? Yeah, that's the
Well, I do think there's a maybe even for a different podcast, a discussion about the supply chain globally after the pandemic. But to answer, so my answer to your question, Dave, is I think the financial sanctions are only going to be effective against real companies, not against governments, right? When you look at governments, you say, okay, hey, what y'all do during the pandemic? Well, the United States, we spent trillions, you know, Great Britain, we spent billions, right? You go around the world, right? Countries don't really have limited budgets. So you put sanctions of billions, they'll be, okay, let me just print some of that for you. Here you go. But companies can feel the pain. Even big companies like Facebook can feel the pain when the EU comes after them. But companies owned by governments may or may not feel that pain, right? You know, if their goal is to take over the world, not to make profit, then maybe these sanctions are meaningless.
Yeah, well, but I think that the next step of this, right, again, drawing together many of these conversations, right, we've had a conversation before about the Huawei situation, right, and 5G, and it was in Britain, and it was locked out of here, and now it's going to be re-deleted from Britain's systems. That plus this equals, well, if you ever suspected maybe there was going to be a two or three internet world, we're forcing that reality, whether that's what we intended or not. And I think that's where people like cool heads need to think carefully, play chess here, not checkers, and think down the road. Cause we could get to a point here with, well, you did that to me, I'm gonna do that to you. And I kicked out your diplomat and you sanctioned my products. I'll give it, if we don't knock it off, we got 18 months before we will have the bifurcation of the splinternet.
Well, so let me pin the bifurcation and make a comment about the security and the criminality piece, and then we'll move on to that. Because I've been making a concerted effort here to talk differently about the way these crimes are described. And I've been using this quippish phrase, and I will use it today too, we have to remember, armed gangs of criminals are breaking into businesses and holding those businesses hostage with weapons. Everything I just said is completely true. And if you put that in the physical world, the end customer, business owners, would be up in arms for police action, for levels of security, for the lockdown of their businesses and the investment. So when I hear people go, oh, nobody wants to spend money on security, I just sort of wave and go, like, you are not talking about it correctly because the threat is so tangible.
Well, and that goes back to, and we all know this, that goes back to day one. The budget for a backup system is unlimited on the day after your hard drive fails.
Right. Well, it so, is.
You know, now suddenly we see, well, you know, how much harm can a little country like North Korea do? Oh, a boatload, it turns out.
A boatload. But let's talk a little bit about this bifurcation issue. And I want to bring it up because I want to talk about it in a particular context. And this is one for, I will cover this story because I have been completely avoiding it. Now, like, for context, because the friggin' story changes every single day. We are recording this on Friday afternoon of August 7th. This matters because the TikTok story has changed every single day this week. So by the time you're listening to this podcast, that date may matter because it may have changed again. because for a little while, the administration comes in and is threatening to shut him down. And then Microsoft was going to do a deal, and then they weren't going to do a deal, and now they're going to do a deal. And as of today, there's an executive order that will ban ByteDance from doing business in the U.S. in 45 days if they are not bought. What's interesting is, of course, there's all this other piece, because they've also banned WeChat, and then there's also, are they going to ban some of the investment of the companies, because it spreads deep throughout the technology world, some of these investments. But where I wanted to talk about this is our thinking on the effect of bifurcation, because we've talked about this a couple of times, this idea of splintering the internet into component regions. I'll throw out that I think I don't care about this story about TikTok or any of those pieces, because ultimately we could have an interesting debate over whether or not China is sucking up all the data. But every research I says the app sucks as much data as Google or Twitter or Facebook does. We just don't like the fact that they're Chinese. Here, by the government getting involved, we may accelerate, or I postulate that we'll accelerate the bifurcation, because now the American internet has a very different meaning of government involvement. Now, am I right or am I wrong, guys?
Well, certainly we have a different perspective, and there's unrelated to this, and we try not to get too deep into the politics here, is whether or not we actually have the authority to cut this off at this level or that level with legislation, without legislation.
Right, sure.
A totally different discussion. But the whole idea that if we're going to go down this road, let me just ask, what is the limit of the number of tiny little bitty data collecting widgets that could be created by the country of China if they chose to? Right. It's sort of like, there are companies that they build a software product simply so they could get bought up by IBM or Intel or somebody else. Like their entire exit strategy is get bought by IBM. Right. Well,
or insert other vendor, particularly these days.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's why I went with different examples.
Yes.
But you know what I mean? I could just imagine doesn't have to be China, but whatever country, bureau of creating widgets that will be forced out of the American market and must be bought by Microsoft.
Yes. The number there is infinite. And Dave, the answer to your question, based on my previous rant, absolutely yes. We will accelerate this, because I read just yesterday a headline, an analytical perspective on what this means technologically, taking the emotion and the politics out of it. And basically what they said was that the stated strategy of this initial move is to eliminate Chinese origin applications from the American marketplace. Now, that is an unbelievably broad strategy. That, like you said, there's how much damage could one big country or a little country do? Well, historically, in a physical world, that was dictated by their GDP and their military prowess. These days, it is not, because even in a small country, you can crank out millions of these little attack bots that are going to be designed for nefarious purposes, right? That's going to happen, and there will come a day where you cannot plug all of those holes in the dam. You cannot individually regulate every single instance of what now. Well, you kick that one out, now you got to do this, and you're going to have an even standard. Quiet the chaos, turn it all off. Absolutely nothing from outside of these approved countries is allowed to access our internet at all. That's just the logical conclusion of what we're beginning right now. And that's why I'm saying, cooler heads, please get involved in this process, because we need to anticipate the domino effect here.
Is the world of data so different, so far removed from the rest of everything else, that it makes sense to somehow do this with data versus little plastic objects and screens and keyboards? And
well, it's a good question, Carl, because I also want to put on a moment and say, if you're sitting over in Europe, who actually care a lot more about privacy than Americans. I could easily see if the U.S. moves in this way, the Europeans going, well, you know what, America, you're kind of a spy master on all of your data, and we're going to ban American companies doing business in Europe because, you know, by the way, no privacy laws. So, you know, before anybody thinks this is only China, like we talked just recently about the idea of four internets.
Right.
You know, and remember that if we're moving against the Chinese version, Chinese smartphones dominate the Indian smartphone market. So we are now essentially saying not only are we not going to play nice with China, we are also not going to play nice with India, which is a whole other bit. And the Europeans are going to probably go, well, maybe not so much with the Americans.
Yeah, and everybody's going to point a finger at somebody, right? Each domain is going to have a justifiable reason, and they're going to have no physical or tangible answer to it. So it will have to become the regulatory conceptual answer to this thing. I believe that every one of us in our capitalist souls, we want access to unfettered global marketplaces where we can access sources of supply and new customer opportunities and exploit the economies of scale in both directions. I want to be able to do business with a billion people, and those billion people want to do access with the richest economy on the planet. And at some point, we're either going to have to agree on what privacy is, or it ain't going to be sustainable.
You could think of the internet not as bifurcation, trifurcation, whatever, but as a series of Venn diagrams, right? Where you say, look, you are entering the North America zone where you understand you're going from level 4 privacy to level 3 privacy, right? Do you want to enter the American zone? Yes, no, right? Now you're over here, you're entering the Indian zone, right? Which has different limitations on content and economics, right? And so, because it's not just the things that we talk about all the time on this show, other stuff as well. You know, when I was in Cambodia, there was lots of discussion about what you do and don't do on the internet, because absolutely everything you do is being monitored and sent to China. And it's not a joke, and it's not a threat, or it's just like a fact. Like, this is what they do, right? They've actually outsourced their censorship to another country.
So what's interesting is, so I want to make this practical for smaller solution providers who are sitting going, these guys are talking about geopolitical moves. What does this have to do with me? I want to make two simple statements. The first is, if you think this doesn't matter to you, I actually would challenge you to put a network sniffer on your own network and watch your machines talk to the rest of the world. I've put in some new network monitoring stuff in my house recently, just for, you know, because I'm a geek and all of those kinds of reasons. It is fascinating to watch the massive amounts of data that my network moves around and the various countries that it talks to because of cloud services. So if you think we're not all interconnected, that's it. The first is, even if you aren't doing business massively across the globe, you could.
Your widgets are.
Right. Your widgets are, and more importantly, your customers are. Lots of small businesses now have massive international reach because of this and do a lot more business across these borders. So think about it. It actually does matter to you a lot more than you may think it does.
And I know we're out of time, but I know somebody who puts in, they literally just block countries at the firewall for all of their clients, right? So no traffic goes to and from Russia or China unless you ask for a pinhole, and has discovered that there are certain IoT devices that simply do not operate.
Yep, there's that too.
The ripple effect.
Very good. Well, we've made another trip around the globe in 30 minutes. So thank you for tuning in. Please like, share, blah, blah, thumbs up.
We haven't asked in a little while. If you like the show, rate us and review us in your podcatcher of choice, Apple, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you do. it seems really small, it actually makes a huge difference in the discoverability of the show. So it's something you can really do to help us get a larger audience, which makes a big difference. So thank you.
Very good. And that will do it for episode 72 of the Killing It.
Killing It
podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.